providing Champaign-Urbana with a wide array of name-brand foods from around the world. Your suggestions and requests are always welcome. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inch. Thanks for tuning in today. This morning, both hours of Focus 580 come from the archives, so as you listen, keep in mind that today we'll not be taking your calls. In this hour of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Timothy Beal. He's professor of religion at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio, and we'll be talking about a book that he's authored entitled Roadside Religion, the subtitle In Search of the Sacred, the Strange, and the Substance of Faith. And it is about some of the places that he visited with his family a couple of years back. This was in the summer of 2002. He and his family rented a motorhome and traveled around the country looking for these kinds of places, places like the world's largest Ten Commandments, for example, 5 feet tall in concrete on the side of a mountain, or a place called the Golgotha Fun Park, which, believe it or not, is a biblical themed miniature golf course. And there are others. He was attracted to these kinds of places and asked some very basic questions of himself and then went out to see if he could find some answers. Questions like, why did people build these things? Who were the people who built them? What was behind it? And was it possible to learn something about the nature of religious faith by going and visiting some of these places? And what he found out is contained in this book, Roadside Religion. It's published by the Beacon Press and has come out now fairly recently. If you're interested in reading the book, you can look for it in the bookstore. As I mentioned, Tim Beal is Florence Harkness Professor of Religion and also Director of the Baker Nord Center for the Humanities at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. He has authored a number of books, including Religion and Its Monsters and The Book of Hiding. His essays have appeared in a number of publications, including The Chronicle of Higher Education, The Cleveland Plain Dealer, and The Washington Post. And he is joining us this morning by telephone. Professor Beal, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much, David. Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe I ask you to start out and tell the story of the first one of these places maybe that you set eyes on. And this was when you had been on the road traveling, doing research for another book, another thing that you were interested in. And as I understand it, you just passed one of these and didn't have the time to stop at the moment, but it definitely grabbed your attention and you thought to yourself, well, now that's pretty interesting. Maybe that's worth a second look.
That's right. We were on our way back as a family from Washington, D.C. I'd been doing some research at the Library of Congress in D.C., and the rest of the family had come along to do the tourist thing in D.C. And we were on our way back to Shaker Heights, Ohio, a little suburban town outside of Cleveland, on Interstate 68, running through southern Maryland and cresting a hill just outside of Frostburg, Maryland, in the Cumberland Mountains. We noticed this large reddish-brown steel girder structure languishing in an open field just north of the highway. It looked like a four-story parking garage under construction or something like that, that had run out of money maybe. But as we passed it, we noticed a big blue sign on which was written, Noah's Ark being rebuilt here. Clover, my wife, is a Presbyterian minister, and I were let's say, as uneasy as we were curious at that particular moment, and so we sped on by. Plus, we had to get the kids, you know, to bed in time for school the next morning. But we kept talking about that ark in progress and the Noah who must be building it and thinking about it. I guess you could say it lingered in our minds a little longer than it took to disappear in our rearview mirrors. And, yeah, the questions went from, you know, the initial sort of what kind of chuckle to deeper questions like who and why and what was the story behind this place. So that by the time we pulled into our driveway in Shaker Heights that evening, we'd begun to hatch plans for a, let's say, summer family travel seminar where we would go and visit places like this Noah's Ark and others we'd heard about and others we would hear about as we planned. And get to know the places, but also get to know the stories behind the places, the who's and the whys.
Yeah. I can understand that you and your wife, you being a professor of religion and she being a clergy, would be interested in this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The kids, apparently, as far as they were concerned, they like the idea of writing in the mobile home, so that part at least was okay with them. And maybe they, by that time, had made their peace with just, you know, what living with parents whose work involved thinking about religion would be. But, you know, how did they feel about this project?
You're so right that, you know, work and home life just get intermixed all the time for our kids. You know, they really didn't stand a chance of getting out of this one, as you point out, with a religion professor dad and a minister mom. But we did want them to go along willingly, if not eagerly, and that's where the motorhome came in. I mean, the motorhome, in one sense, was a practical decision. A lot of the places we were planning on visiting on that first summer road trip were pretty far off of the interstate intersections of clusters of, you know, Hojos and Super 8s and Red Roof Inns, and so it made practical sense to combine transportation with lodging. But we also thought of the motorhome, Clover and I, as a lure for the kids. I've never seen a motorhome in a driveway in Shaker Heights, Ohio, and I'm not sure that the kids knew that regular people were allowed to have these things, to ride in these things. They were just fascinated by the idea of a motorhome, the idea that you could, you know, be flying down the highway while sitting on the couch playing cards or, you know, watching a video or going to the fridge to get some Cocoa Puffs or something. So I think we could have planned a trip to visit the chicken slaughterhouses of Arkansas for a month, and the kids would have gladly gone along so long as they were able to log all the miles in this motorhome.
Mm. The kinds of places that you describe, they're very different. Everything from the biblical miniature golf course to a place that's essentially a Christian biblical theme park,
mm-hmm.
to places that are much different. The scale is different, and they seem to be a much more personal expression. In a sense, they're all personal expressions, but I'm thinking of places like the Cross Garden,
mm-hmm.
that is indeed a very, very personal expression of an individual's faith. Can you talk a little bit about the range of kind of experiences that you had?
Sure. There were the very slick, highly produced kinds of places. The main one that I write about in the book is the Holy Land Experience in Orlando, Florida, which is a $16 million, let's say, Disney-esque recreation of the Holy Land. It fits right in with the other theme parks in Orlando, very high production values, live actors, very slick, not very personal. Actually, in some ways, very, I would say, ideological. It's driven by a certain kind of fundamentalist Christian Zionist ideology that the founder of the place is interested in promoting. There's that on the one end, but I have to say that the places that really did, that I found most compelling and most moving were those places that were much more personal. You mentioned Cross Gardens, and that's a good example, but places where there was this convergence of the highly personal, private, religious experience on the one hand with the spectacularly, outrageously public on the other hand, this convergence of the personal and the public, especially in these places that really were also the person's home. And Cross Gardens, again, is a great example. Cross Garden is an 11-acre sort of visual cacophony of crosses and broken appliances and scrap boards and so forth, all bearing messages of hellfire and damnation. You know, hell is hot, you will die, rich man in hell, repent. It's a very overwhelming sort of place to visit, and when we first pulled up, you know, I got out of the motorhome the kids in Clover decided that
they didn't want to have, they said, we'll stay here. You can go and look around. We'll just stay
here. Exactly. They decided to wait it out in the motorhome, even though the air conditioner was pooping out on us. But, you know, eventually wandering around there, feeling rather overwhelmed, I wasn't really taking it in. It was taking me in. But eventually Marzell Rice, wife of Bill Rice, who started this place and worked on it until he died about a year and a few months ago, Marzell Rice saw me out there and welcomed me into their little ranch home, and we sat and talked, Bill and Marzell and I, over sweet tea for at least a couple hours. I learned their story and got to know the place, and especially, you know, the personal dimensions of it, and came away with a much different understanding of that place as a sort of safe place for them, as a kind of nest, in fact, in a way. And that was the experience I often had in these places that were, on the one hand, very public, spectacular kinds of expressions of faith, but on the other hand, very personal, private, you know, experiences driving them.
And your wife and the kids were persuaded to get out of the motorhome and meet the folks.
That's right. Bill and Marzell had heard that I talked with him ahead of time and wrote him a letter, and he knew that I would be coming with the family. In fact, he offered to let us hook the motorhome up there and stay in their yard. Politely declined the offer, but he was very excited to meet the kids and to meet Clover. And so, after we'd been talking for a long time, he asked if he could, and so I went over and coaxed them out. they eventually did come out and meet him and wander around a little bit, and he was very pleased. You know, they would have had to have heard the whole story that I had heard, I think, to feel comfortable with him and in that place. And eventually they did hear it. But in that particular moment, I think I felt a little more identified with him and in some strange way a little distanced from my own family because they hadn't shared the experience I had of hearing this person's story.
Maybe very quickly here, I'll reintroduce our guest. We're talking with Timothy Beal. He's professor of religion at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. And we're talking about some of what you will find in his recent book, Roadside Religion, In Search of the Sacred, the Strange, and the Substance of Faith. That's the subtitle. It's published by the Beacon Press. And as he explained at the beginning of the interview, it's the product of an experience that he had, he and his family, who back in 2002, one summer, rented an RV and traveled around the country looking for and looking at some of the kinds of places that he just described as a way of trying to understand something of who the people were that created them and why they did it and what you can learn about religious faith in the process of doing that. And it's a very interesting book.
Thank you. You
might go out and take a look at it. And as I said, questions are welcome too. 333-WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-9455. In talking about some of the people that you talk about, particularly, again, I guess I find myself thinking about these folks who made this place that you just talked about. You borrow a term from the art world, and there is a term for artists who, I guess they're the kind of people I suppose we would call folk artists, people who are not formally trained, they didn't go to art school, they're not doing mainstream kind of stuff. They have some kind of vision, and they feel just compelled to make it, and it's called outsider art.
Mm-hmm.
And you've borrowed that term, and I think it seems to me that it works fairly well to describe what you're talking about here as outsider religion.
Exactly. Yeah, in fact, Bill Rice is a good example for that, David, because he is one of the folk artists who is recognized by many who are interested in outsider art as an outsider artist. When I visited him, he was interested in the fact that I, as a religion professor, wanted to visit him. He said that he finds it's mostly art teachers and artists and that type who come out to his place to visit it and talk with him. Outsider art refers, it's been nuanced in various ways, and you know, sometimes you'll now hear terms such as self-taught artists or vernacular artists or naive artists. There are various other terms used now to sort of subcategories of outsider art, I guess you could say. But generally, we can say outsider art refers to the work of artists who don't have formal training, who stand outside the cultural norms of fine art, of the fine art schools and museums and galleries, and don't really have any relationship to the trends and developments that are there in the contemporary art world. I think it's striking to anyone who looks at outsider art how many of those outsider artists are religiously inspired in some way in their art. And that was striking me thinking about places like Bill Rice's Cross Garden and also Howard Finster's Paradise Gardens, which I visit as well. And so I came up with this term, outsider religion. I think in the same way that outsider art, these very individual, very peculiar works of outsider art can sometimes reveal in powerful ways the breadth and depth of human creativity and vision in really local, particular ways, I think that the kinds of places that I explore in this book that I'd think of as outsider religion can reveal some of the breadth and depth of human religious experience and expression. I think that religion is often most interesting and most revealing where it's least expected. And that's, I guess, part of what I was trying to get at by thinking of these as outsider religion.
We have several callers. Let's bring them into the conversation. We'll start with someone here on a cell phone on our line number 4.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just have a question. I'm going to ask it and then hang up and listen, but I was wondering if the guest had heard about or seen the cross in Effingham, Illinois, that's mm-hmm. by the highway.
Yeah. Hi. I have. That's there on Interstate 70, I think, or where Interstate 57 and 70 intersect, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the cross at the crossroads.
Well, I was wondering if you could tell a little bit about that. I live in the area, but I'm not familiar with the story, and I'll just hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you brought that up. It's close by, so your listeners can go and check it out. It was actually still under construction in to some extent when I was taking that first trip. It was completed in 2001, but they've continued to add some things since then. It's a almost 200-foot-tall cross in Effingham, Illinois, there where Interstate 57 and 70 intersect. And I believe that it was a Baptist church in Effingham that originally established this foundation. It's called the Cross Foundation, I think, to build this cross. It's, like I said, about 200 feet high. It's lit up with big lights at night. Around the base of it now, there are these granite slabs of the Ten Commandments, ten granite statues, each with one of the commandments on it. I believe that the founder or the person who was responsible for this cross, or getting it going anyway, has fairly recently died, and I don't know if he was the minister of that church or what, but it's got vinyl siding, I think, on the outside of it, and it's a big steel frame. That's what I know about it.
and I know that I'm looking right now, there actually is a website for it,
right.
And I'm looking at it right now, and they do have a an organization, but there's not a whole lot. At least the page I'm looking at now has a little bit of details about it, sort of how big it is,
mm-hmm.
and there are some photographs of it. But it doesn't. Well, I guess there are some photographs here. That's interesting, of other giant crosses.
Oh, okay.
Around the country.
Sure.
And other than that, it doesn't really include a lot of detail about who put it up and
right.
why and all that sort of thing. But
I think the express intention is something like that it would serve as a beacon of hope for all of the mm-hmm. many thousands of people who drive by every day on the interstate. I don't know. Things always mean more than we intend them to mean, and I think even we mean more than we know we mean. But a beacon of hope is maybe one thing that a gigantic cross might try to communicate. I have to think that kind of expression also has a more sort of assertive dimension to it, especially when you think about building the Ten Commandments around the base of it. I mean, these Ten Commandments, these monuments of the Ten Commandments have become battlegrounds in some way in the culture wars about biblical values versus secular and so forth. But I don't know much about those who are behind this particular place, and so I wouldn't want to go too far with that. I did decide not to write about giant crosses. There are many around the country. There's one, I think, in Indiana that competes with this one for size. I'm fascinated by just the idea that someone wants to... I guess I'm fascinated with why bigness is so valuable, is so important as a cultural expression mm-hmm. in our country.
Let us talk with some others.
Sure.
Next in Mattoon, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I was also going to ask about the cross in Effingham, so I'm glad that you had a chance to see it. The gentleman who promoted it really did it as an individual thing, and
is that right?
Attended his funeral. He wasn't a pastor. He was just someone that in the latter part of his life took this upon as kind of a personal mission to have done.
Interesting. Well, that's interesting. I'm glad to know that.
And the other thing I wanted to ask was, are these kind of roadside religious attractions, is that something kind of unique to American culture, or do you know if those are pop up in other societies also?
I think that's
not there.
All right. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. That's a very good question. I'm glad to know that about the person behind this place. I must have gotten some misinformation. This wasn't one of the places I studied, but I had heard somewhere that there was a church behind this. It's interesting that it's an individual behind it, because it makes me think about another cross phenomenon in the country. I'm sure many listeners have seen the sets of two blue and one gold wooden cross all over the highways of the United States, and these were the result of a man named Coffendorfer, who had made his money in coal washing in West Virginia, and when he retired, he spent his fortune on having these crosses put up all around the country. He's died since, but it's been the mission has been carried on, and there are maybe over 2,000 of these sets of crosses now all around the country. Again, an individual behind it, but then it became a sort of communal project in some sense. Now, the question the caller had, I think it's a great question, is there something uniquely American about this phenomenon? And I think that there are certain uniquely American dimensions to it. On the other hand, there are in the East these giant Buddhas, and they'll be advertised as such, the world's largest seated Buddha, the world's largest bronze Buddha, the world's largest fully enclosed Buddha. And so other cultures maybe have something like this some kind of religious attractions like this. But I think that maybe in American culture, religion in America has a particular orientation toward privileging personal experience and personal religious expression and personal faith, and so in a very public way. And so these places, as as convergences of the personal and the public make, I think, particularly good sense, maybe even are predictable in the context of American culture and American religion.
You know, one, I think it strikes me that one of the great risks that people who create these things expose them to is the possibility that by their neighbors or by anybody who might pass by, that they would become the object of ridicule.
Yeah.
Which, and I want to underscore that is not what you were doing, even though I think there's been some controversy surrounding you and the book by people who somehow think it's that you're poking fun at these people, which you most definitely are not.
Thank you.
That's not what you're about at all. You're as you said, your interest is using this as a way to explore religious faith and what that's all about. But again, going back to the essential issue that it really that is these people are indeed putting themselves in the position of being ridiculed. How do they feel about that?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you for saying that about the book. There was one review that suggested that it was in some sense condescending, and you know, I certainly tried not to be, and I'm glad to hear that you don't think it is, and other reviews have agreed with you, I'm glad to say. You know, it was important for me not to be condescending. I guess as a scholar of religion, what I'm all about is encountering things that seem strange and that are unfamiliar and other, and trying to come to a place where I can maybe understand them even if I don't completely identify with them. That is to say, come to a place where I can see how they could be true for someone according to a certain story or within a certain context. And that really was my goal with these places, was to come to a place of understanding, which had to do with getting to know the story behind each of the places. Your question about the anxiety that someone might feel about doing something like this, you know, that is a very public expression of a very private experience, I encountered that again and again in the stories I heard. Bill Rice is a good example. The first cross he felt called by God to put up was shortly after his parents both died, and he felt called to tack up three business cards in the shape of a cross above his door in his kitchen. And then soon after that, he felt called to put some out in his front yard, and soon after that, more. And he struggled with this. He felt this compulsion to do it, but also he didn't want to. He was afraid of being embarrassed. He was afraid of being laughed at. Another example is the Noah that we started talking about in the beginning, Pastor Richard Green, who is building the Ark on the hill in Frostburg, Maryland. He had a month. He had a series of dream visions over the course of about a month, and that made him feel like he was being called to build an ark. He didn't want to tell anyone. He didn't want to tell his family. He didn't want to tell his church. He was a minister in a church at the time, because he was afraid of putting his family in the public eye, and he was afraid of them being ridiculed. He was afraid that he would be ridiculed. And, you know, I suppose for each of the people I visited, why wouldn't they feel that same anxiety about me? I mean, here I am. I'm a religion professor. I'm coming to study them. You got to watch out for religion professors sometimes anyway, and you know, condescending is something that we have to avoid being, and there is that temptation sometimes. They don't know me from Adam, and I'm coming, and they're telling me their stories in such profoundly vulnerable ways, so self-revealing, and I do feel a certain sense of accountability and responsibility in communicating that story with others who read the book. I you know, there was a kind of hospitality in what they were extending to me. That is to say, they were opening themselves up, their own lives up, to me, a stranger, and you know, I felt a certain responsibility actually to respond in kind, and the book ended up being a much more personal reflection on a much more personal book in many ways, a religious book, really, in many ways. And I felt compelled to see where my own story connected with the places I was visiting and the stories behind them.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Timothy Beale. He's Florence Harkness Professor of Religion and Director of the Baker Nord Center for the Humanities at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and is author of this book, Roadside Religion, published by the Beacon Press. It's out now if you'd like to look at it. Questions here are welcome. The lines are full. We'll get back to listeners, and we'll go first to Indiana, I think. Caller number on line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
First to comment, it's interesting to see these things interpreted from a religious person, because it's certainly a simple way to understand how they think. Mm. My question is this. With the people you talked to who told about their beliefs, did any of them, in terms of history of religion, have what we now would be understand as heretical ideas that were either put away with by the Catholics or the early Protestants? Thanks.
That's an interesting question. That's not the kind of question I tend to ask while I'm getting to know someone and their own religious beliefs. But I think there is some sense in at least in some of the cases of in this outsider religious expression, I don't know if heretical is an evaluative term, but certainly many of the beliefs and expressions of faith that were there on the sides of the highway that we visited would be seen as outside the mainstream, outside the norms of faith and norms of Christian religion. So I suppose, if I were looking for that, I might have seen it. One that strikes me in relation to that question is a place called Holy Land USA, which is a 250-acre, 1-to-100 scale recreation of the land of Palestine during the time of Jesus. And you visit this place, you tour this place on these flatbed trailers with school bus seats bolted down to them, pulled behind a four-wheel drive truck, and you start in Bethlehem down south, and then you follow this trail up to Galilee, and you visit the workshop where Joseph and Jesus, were working away on their carpentry, and you see Peter's house up there, and this is where Jesus, was raised and began his ministry. And then you follow down the Jordan Valley, which is a creek bed, and end up in Jerusalem, where the empty tomb is, and above that, Calvary, where the three crosses are. So you're touring this place, and in the process of touring the space, having this virtual experience of Palestine, you are walking, you're traveling through the biblical narrative. And so space and time are converging here. It's a kind of spatialization of biblical narrative. As you go through, as you traverse the land, you traverse the story. And it strikes me that this is a kind of pilgrimage. In fact, the others we were on the tour with definitely experienced it as a kind of pilgrimage, with a very profound religious experience at the end for many of them. And that struck me as interesting, because within Protestant tradition, the kind of material aesthetics that are so central in Catholicism are often dismissed and rejected. And in fact, when you go back to the early reformers like Luther and Calvin, they would talk about pilgrimage in particular as what was wrong with the Catholic Church. And yet here, ironically, with Holy Land USA, you have a kind of evangelical Protestant pilgrimage practice.
Well, let's go on to the next caller in the nearby community here, Belgium, over by Danville, line four. Hello.
Hi.
Good morning, sirs.
Yes.
Good
morning.
Just a minor correction for you, if I could, sir.
Sure.
Frostburg is actually in western Maryland. I've driven by the place many, many times on I-68. You said it was in southern Maryland.
Oh, sorry.
That's more D.C. A totally different idea there.
Right. My mistake. Sorry.
No problem. What I wanted to maybe bring to your attention, this might be slightly different from what you're really talking about here, but I'm sure it's intertwined. I'm sure you've noticed as you've gone by on the byways all over the United States, crosses alongside the road where people have had accidents and passed away.
Yeah.
And we see many, many, many of many more, especially here in the Midwest. I don't see them so much in the East and the West as much as I do here in the Midwest.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be a phenomenon that might be tied somewhat to what you're talking about. Now, this is obviously not where the people are interred, but this is where the accident happened and where they actually passed away.
Right, right.
And on some places you see a stone monument with a cross and many, many things with it. Others are just nothing more than a wreath and a small little sign says mother or something like that.
Right.
Do you have any thoughts along those concepts?
It's a great question. I think you're right that there is a certain kinship between these kinds of spontaneous sacred spaces being erected on the side of the road where someone dies, little memorials, and the kinds of places I'm visiting. There's sort of maybe micro phenomena of this same kind of roadside religion, less spectacular, of course, but still nonetheless very public and very private and personal at the same time. And of course, there are sacred places, and I don't mean that from a personally religious perspective. I mean they are erected and consecrated and in some sense protected, I guess you could say, as sacred, as set apart, in that they mark a passing. They mark a passing into death for that particular person. These kinds of locuses are often marked as sacred in religious traditions. And I think what is particularly fascinating to me about them is it seems to me anyway that no one or very few would dare mess with something like this, would dare come along and say, hey, this is you know, part of the highway's, you know, property or whatever, and we need to remove this. And so they stay up. There's a certain social collective recognition.
Well, that's what I was going to go on with here. Mm, mm-hmm. I have spoken to people who work for the highway departments and stuff.
Oh, really?
And they are not very happy about them.
Uh-huh.
They do cause a great deal of problem, but and they're conflicted, just like you say.
Yeah.
Because they do have a very, very personal meaning to the individuals. And some of them do get very garish. I mean, some of them do go over the pale. You know what I mean? They get very, very involved in lots of, you know, personal mementos and
right, stuffed animals.
Yes, and, lots of things like that, all mm-hmm. kinds of things. And the people at the highway department don't really know what to do at all because
right.
technically they should not be there.
Right.
But at the same time, they do not want to move them.
Right.
So it might at some point become a problem.
It's fascinating, and I can see how it's a problem from the highway's perspective, also potentially as a distraction, a potential safety problem, highway safety problem as well.
Some of them are large enough that if you ran into them, they'd kill you.
Oh, Lord, that's not a good thought, is it?
There's one on Interstate, on State Highway 63 going north towards Chicago, and it's a large stone cross that's set. I think they finally forced them to push it farther off the highway because it was very large. I mean, it was, maybe 10 feet tall, solid stone set in concrete. These people went to a great deal of effort.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, that could be dangerous for another individual.
It's sort of a kind of vigilante sacred space creation.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
I think I think as you and the guest were discussing, that there are some states where the highway departments are really concerned about these mm-hmm. things creating distraction, and I think that they have managed to make their peace with it by saying people would be allowed to do certain sorts of things and not others.
Ah, right.
To make them of a small sort of manageable
right.
kind of scale.
To institutionalize them in some sense and set up regulations. Very interesting.
Let's talk with someone in Kingman, Indiana. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I want to go back a little bit to something that you said earlier that really caught my attention because it was different than something that I had heard. You were talking about the three sets of crosses, the blue and the gold crosses mm-hmm. that are all over the country. And I had a conversation with a gentleman in a public library who was doing research on the KKK. And he told me that the crosses set where they were an indication of a meeting site for the KKK. And he showed me a newspaper clipping of a grand dragon in his barn lot with the crosses in the background.
Wow.
And so I was wondering if you had any knowledge of that. Am I completely off base? This fellow was doing research on a book, I think.
Well, I have not done extensive research on these sets of crosses, but I am quite sure that they began and that most of them are the work of this Coffendorfer. I don't know his own background, actually, or whether he would have any connection to something like that. I kind of doubt it. On the other hand, you know, they could have been, they could become meeting places, whether they were created.
You did talk earlier about sometimes we have unintended consequences, and
yeah, exactly.
Meetings extend beyond ourselves. So,
well, hopefully that would be to Coffin Daffer's horror to hear that.
Very interesting show. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's talk next with someone in Champaign. That would be line number three. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I haven't read the book, and this is just a comment, not a question. But I saw during the last Pope's funeral, he had a kayak, and he made a cross out of his kayak paddles. And I thought that was a really original idea, and the altar was the kayak turned upside down. And I just wanted to say, I thought you'd be interested in that.
Thank you.
Yes, bye-bye.
All right. Bye. Well, that's the first I had heard that story.
Yeah, me too.
All right. Well, let's go and talk with someone else. This is Gibson City. We'll get them next here, line two. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of in the same line as the last caller, is that I don't know if anybody knows it, but the Mennonites have Nazareth Village in Nazareth, Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They have, what it was like in Jesus' time. And I did get a chance to visit it while we were over there, and it was really very interesting, and it is still a work in progress, but they have like a synagogue where Jesus would have been. And
is this in Israel?
Yeah, in Nazareth.
Okay.
And I think it's next to the YMCA or something like that, and it's Mennonite Mark Hochsettler, a Mennonite from the States here, went over there and
interesting.
And started it. And I just thought, I didn't know if you knew about it, but... And I was just trying to find, I know there's a website for it, and unfortunately I don't have the sheet of paper handy to give you it, but I know
I'll have to look it up.
Yeah, but the only thing is we happened to be in Nazareth, and I knew it was there, and I went to, another friend and I went, and unfortunately we didn't have a chance to sign up for the meal, because they also serve a meal where the bread is cooked on stone. And
uh-huh.
And,
give you the whole virtual experience.
So I just thought people might like to know that, and if they do ever go over to, you know, to Israel and get a chance to go to Nazareth, that would be something worthwhile seeing.
Interesting. That's I didn't really focus on these kinds of recreations of biblical story worlds in other parts of the world, but it's fascinating to me that in Nazareth, you would recreate ancient Nazareth. I guess it's a recreation on a time scale. But that's fascinating. The Mennonites actually have some history of biblical recreation, let's call it, in the United States as well. In Pennsylvania, there is a tabernacle that is built to biblical specifications. And I think a Mennonite community is behind that, and they have a biblical theater as well.
Do you know, by any chance, know what town it's in?
You know, I think it's near Lancaster.
Okay,
in the Lancaster, Pennsylvania area.
Okay, but I just thought you'd like to know that. And the interesting thing is, when it was first opened up, it was during the time of, I think, the First Intifada.
Oh.
And so the first guests actually were Palestinian school children.
Uh-huh.
And it was really very interesting. So,
interesting.
But anyway, I just thought you might like to know that, and I hope to get it. I haven't read your book yet, but I'd hope to get a chance to do that.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks
for
the call.
You.
We have maybe about 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Timothy Beale. The book is Roadside Religion. It's published by the Beacon Press. In the introduction of the book, you say something I think is really interesting. You write the fact that you tell your students that the study of religion is fundamentally about making the strange familiar and the familiar strange. I like that turn of phrase very much. Is there some way in which that impulse or that activity enters into what it is that you were doing here with this project, with going to visit the places that we have, some of the places that we talked about?
Yes, very much. That's really what I was trying to be about in this particular book. I tell my students that's what the study of religion is about. I think in a way that's what all education should be about. It's about encountering things that appear to us initially, when we're talking about religion, it's about encountering religious ideas and practices and institutions and beliefs that appear to us often initially to be very strange, to be unfamiliar, other in some sense, and coming to a point through study where we can see how they make sense for someone, how they are true in some sense, how and that's what understanding is about, and it is about getting to know the context, the social context, the historical context, learning the story behind the place. I think in the process of making the strange familiar, often we find that the familiar becomes more strange. And we talked a little bit earlier about that experience of having my family come out and meet Bill Rice after he had become somewhat familiar to me, and I realized standing there with my kids and my wife, who still saw him as rather strange, that I had become in some sense a little strange to them, that I would want them to meet him and that I would have this sort of rapport with him. And I think often when we're studying what are initially unfamiliar, strange religious ideas, practices, institutions, and so on, in the process of doing that, we begin to see how our own religious ideas, practices, and so forth are strange. We gain some distance on them, I think, in a way, and that definitely is part of what I experienced with this book, and certainly that's what I was about in getting to know these places.
Hmm. You explain in the introduction of the book that you were raised as an evangelical Christian,
mm-hmm.
and that while you perhaps don't approach faith in the same way now as an adult as you did as a child, that
mm-hmm.
you still think of yourself as a Christian and still wrestle with the same sorts of questions. Did the process of making this trip and visiting these places and talking with these people have some sort of influence on the way, on whatever your personal faith might be?
Yes. Well, I think for one thing, and I didn't really expect this, but I found it necessary to get in touch with my own conservative evangelical Christian background in ways more sympathetic than I'm used to doing. Being an ex conservative evangelical, you move away from it for various reasons that have to do with, you know, critical problems that have developed in relation to that particular tradition. And as you point out, I still am a Christian. I'm married to a minister, for crying out loud, and teach Sunday school even sometimes. I don't sing in the choir or play organ, but I'm something of a minister's wife, I guess you could say. So I'm very much identified with Christianity still and with the church, but not with conservative evangelical Christianity. And yet, I think, you know, anyone who has grown up in that very strong tradition, you might leave it, but it's still going to be part of you. And we often had the experience, Clover and I, Clover has the same background, while visiting these places, of being very familiar with the language and the culture and the allusions, the biblical allusions and so forth, and knowing it sort of intimately, the lingo and all of that, and yet not fully identifying with it anymore, sort of having one foot in and one foot out, I guess you could say, yeah. Being of it but not in it.
Well, that's, you know, being an evangelical Christian, I think there's very strong emphasis placed on witnessing, and the kind
yeah.
of things that you're talking about here are, this is extreme witnessing, if
it
anything is.
It is. It is indeed, yeah. Sometimes not with a kind of proselytizing sort of emphasis. Not, that is to say, witnessing isn't always about trying to convert somebody. And I think that, you know, that's something that we could keep in mind in thinking about conservative evangelical Christianity. Witnessing is also about telling one's story and about sharing one's personal experience as a way of creating a kind of relationship with someone. And I think that some of these places were witnessing in the sense of expressing and sharing personal experience, but not necessarily with an interest in conversion.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there because we're here to the end of the time. It's a very interesting book, and
thank
I certainly
you.
Appreciate you taking some time to talk with us.
It's my pleasure, David. Thank you so much, and thanks to your callers for some great questions.
Our guest, Timothy Beal, he's professor of religion at Case Western Reserve University. That's in Cleveland, Ohio. And if you'd like to read the book, the title is Roadside Religion, In Search of the Sacred, the Strange, and the Substance of Faith, and it's published by the Beacon Press. You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 archive. Other Focus interviews, along with shows from the Afternoon Magazine, in fact, all of our local production, is available for you to listen to anytime you like. It's at WILL.UIUC.EDU. In hour number two, we'll have another show from the archive, so we hope that you will stay with us. Coming up in just a moment, we'll have news, so please stay tuned.
Focus 580 is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety, a division of Carl Foundation Hospital, is proud to underwrite agricultural programming at WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, I'm Jay Pierce with this update on agriculture at 10:58 and a half. September wheat on the Board of Trade at 3:30 and a half, up 3 and a half. December wheat up 2 right now at 344 and a half as the market is reacting to more weather news. Some rain was clearly beneficial to some of the growing area, not all, but the hot temperatures we're expecting through the weekend are having an impact now. And September corn is up a half at 2.